This FPL season has definitely been go, go, go. A nonstop hustle all the time. Matches, deadlines, unexpected blank and double game weeks, on top of everything the real world has had in store. Sometimes you need a moment to turn off and hit reset. That's when you reach for Coors Light. It's made to chill. For me personally, supporting Fulham during this last year has been a true roller coaster ride. Honestly, when that Adama Traore goal flew past Areola in the 92nd minute of game week 31, the only thing that saved my mental state, the only thing that calmed my nerves, was cracking open a Coors Light. There's only one beer out there that's literally made to chill, and that's Coors Light. The mountains on the bottles and cans even turn blue when your beer is cold. That way, you always know when it's time to chill. When you need to hit reset, just open a Coors Light. It's mountain cold refreshment made to chill. And listen, everyone, summer is pretty much here. It's about to get hot in New York. An ice-cold Coors Light is such a perfect way for me to beat that summertime heat. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light and the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. And as always, celebrate. Hey, all cheaters, and welcome to the Always Cheating Fantasy Premier League podcast. My name is Josh. I'm here with Brandon. Brandon, how are you?
I'm good, Josh. You did mention Fantasy Premier League just there, and some might know that the FPL, it's not happening right now.
Sure.
We're kind of in the midst of a break. We haven't podcasted in 3 weeks. I feel like I miss you, Josh.
I know. I feel the same way, and it's hard for me to say that. But now I didn't even say it. Actually, I disagree with you, so I'm off the hook. I miss doing the podcast for sure. You know, I'll go that far.
Yeah, we're starting to get that itch, that sensation that maybe we should actually be doing something here at Always Cheating. And good things come to those who wait. We've got a fantastic tournament that's about to kick off this Friday, the 2019 Women's World Cup in France. And it's just not going to be me and you, Josh, just a couple of homies in Brooklyn talking about the Women's World Cup.
That would be terrible.
So, you went out and found us a good guest. His name is Jeff Kasouf, coming to us from the great website EqualizerSoccer.com. It's a one-stop shop for all of your needs as far as women's football coverage goes. And Jeff is also the co-author of a book, The Making of the Women's World Cup, Defining Stories from a Sports Coming of Age. So we talked to Jeff about the teams to watch this World Cup, what's going on in the state of play with women's football here in the U.S. and globally. And we had a great conversation with him.
Let's get right to it.
Yeah, without further ado, let's announce our guest. It's Jeff Kasouf. Did I get that right, Jeff?
Yeah. Jeff Kasouf,
Jeff Kasouf, you are the author of the book, The Making of the Women's World Cup, Defining Stories from a Sports Coming of Age. This book is available in the UK, in the US, other territories, surely.
Yeah, I think the UK site can get you the book pretty much anywhere from what I've been told, certainly anywhere in Europe. And I think we had someone from Brazil buy from the UK site.
Jeff, tell us quickly a little bit about yourself. You work for The Equalizer. What is that?
Yeah, I founded The Equalizer in 2009. It's our 10th anniversary in July. Women's soccer digital outlet, exclusively women's soccer. It was founded on that premise that just there's not enough coverage of the women's game. And certainly in 2009, I mean, there was next to nothing. And I think there's a lot of new fans in the game that kind of see, yes, there's a lot of talk about a lack of coverage now, and it's a lot better than it was, still certainly not great. So, that was the founding, just bringing a, I guess equal coverage is a fair way to put it, of just, you know, what we see in the men's game from the stories, the tactics, everything else to the women's game. So, been running that for 10 years. I've worked at NBC and on the Premier League for a while, actually, in that and 442 and some other places as well. And this has been sort of my baby, I guess, this website. So
awesome. And so it's three of us right now, three guys talking about to talk about the Women's World Cup. Tell us about the women that are involved with the Equalizer.
Yeah, we've got a pretty wide staff geographically. You know, we've got about a split, even split of men and women spread out throughout the country. We've got a couple internationally. It's a great team. I mean, honestly, you know, I founded it in 2009, it was kind of alone, did that for, I'm not sure, maybe a couple of years. And we started to add some folks, some contributors. And now, I mean, I think we're as large as ever. We're, you know, about a dozen sort of regular folks, you know, top of my head, I think, you know, something like 50-50 in terms of men and women and just, you know, overall, I mean, dedicated people dedicated, you know, to seeing the game grow and very, very knowledgeable folks on the women's game and dating back even to, you know, some of the happenings in the past cycles and even past decades.
So, I guess I'm sort of curious. I want to ask you about the book in a second, but just while we're talking about, you know, the growth of your site, I mean, so this World Cup is in, you know, it's in France this year. It was in Canada 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's not, you know, it's not in the, you know, in that sort of Eastern or the American time zones right now, but are you still, does it feel like every year the excitement is like each sort of World Cup is like building on the last one in terms of fan interest and excitement?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, 2011 was kind of a turning point from an American's point of view. You know, there's a lot of reference to 1999, obviously. And I think what's lost in that is from 99 to essentially 2011, there was, I mean, I don't know if you'd call it the dark years of soccer for the U.S. women, but certainly by that moment in 2011, Abby Wambach hits that equalizer in the quarterfinal in the 122nd minute. And that's where you kind of see that turning point. Up until there, I mean, you go back and you look at even 2010, the year before the World Cup, the U.S. women are playing in front of crowds of like 3,000 people. I mean, it was tough. Yeah. And that popularity kind of sagged, you know, that some of the stars of the past generation were obviously gone. And so from there, I think you've seen that upturn. 2015 obviously was, you know, the big boom there. And now 2019, I mean, I think there are a lot of folks who are, you know, I guess from a media perspective, I look at it and it's probably similar to fans. There are a lot of folks who kind of caught that bug in 2015. This team's obviously only grown in popularity in terms of everything is doing off the field, never mind on it. And so now I think, you know, certainly continuing to grow and certainly the attention on it is more than ever.
Even though Brent and I are both in Brooklyn, I actually remember where I was in 1999 when the U.S. won the Women's World Cup. I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was actually on the quad. It was amazing. There was so much excitement. I'm not sure if it was because it was a college town or what exactly, but it was a huge moment when they won there. So
did you have some of those devil sticks? They're hanging out there on the quad.
I did not. No, it was no, sadly. But it was, you know, it was a great moment. So I've been following the women's game for, you know, for 20 years now. But I don't want to be too U.S. focused in this podcast. So I want to talk about the 2019 World Cup in a second. But just the book itself, you know, how did it come about? You know, who do you see as the audience? Has this been in the works for a while, this book?
No, it's actually we had a pretty quick turnaround by, you know, by all standards of books anyway. Little Brown, who's the publisher in the UK and you know, has other outlets that are, you know, US and everything. You know, they came to us and they wanted to, you know, the Women's World Cup was upcoming. They knew that they wanted sort of a book that kind of told some of the background and to the point of there being a lot of newer fans, you know, an idea of kind of painting the picture of how we got here and this explosion in popularity for the sport, certainly for the U.S. team. So there was, you know, I'd say it started honestly with a vision from the publisher, which is, you know, always a must for buy-in. You know, and then we went from there and kind of worked on, you know, what can we do? Certainly some of it, I guess, is what can we do in the timeline? And you know, the publisher being UK, US focused, a lot of the focus of the book is on those two markets. And thankfully for, I guess, the concept of the book, the US is such a storied program that it kind of allows you to make half of a book about the U.S., even though it might feel disproportionate. So,
well, in England in its own right is a really up and coming nation in the women's game. I mean, we just need to say the name Phil Neville leading that.
Hey, Brandon, how about Lucy Bronze, which is one of the great names. But I mean, Lucy Bronze is considered like the greatest right back in the world right now, right? Isn't she? Or she's certainly up in the top couple.
Yeah, she is. She is. And Neville has kind of toyed with her at least briefly in the spring as a defensive midfielder, which was drew some eyebrow raising. But we'll see if he tries that in a World Cup match. I'm not sure that necessarily. He at least told the press that he was very intrigued by the option. So it was a little bit odd.
So this will be a fun book for people to pick up and read sort of as the Women's World Cup unfolds. The matches start this Friday, June 7th. So it seems like the perfect pairing. Like, learn a little bit about where we are currently with the women's game and also watch some incredible football while you catch up.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, to the point of who's it for, I mean, it's very digestible. It's made for, you know, both the casual fan who's probably come into this tournament, maybe not knowing a lot about the current teams or even some of the background of those teams. And, you know, for the more diehard fan, offering a bit of insight into some things that I'm sure they're aware of on a surface level, but trying to bring a little bit of background color. You know, an example being, I mean, for 2015, I followed the U.S. team throughout the tournament and covered them. So, you know, I'm able to kind of give some behind the scenes of what things looked like, the mood around the team, certainly as they struck through the group stage, you know, the things that you wouldn't necessarily see just tuning in on TV. So it's geared toward that casual fan that, you know, wants to kind of get caught up. And also, you know, some of the more diehards will find some interesting information in it. But I would say too, you know, each chapter is essentially for, you know, more or less independent of the other. So you can kind of read it as you go. I mean, each chapter is dedicated to a team / tournament.
I love books like that. I have a couple of collected. Simon Cooper has a book that's sort of like that, where it's just like these sort of little potted stories. And that sounds like a great read. So let's get into the 2019 World Cup. As Brandon just said, it kicks off on Friday. Just for someone who is just, you know, so a lot about it, it was interesting. I was at a bar in Brooklyn called the Black Horse on Saturday for the Champions League final.
No one's ever heard of it who listens to this podcast, John.
I was talking to, we had a listener there who was from Australia, and then I had a friend who was from North London. And we were sort of talking about the Women's World Cup that was kicking off this Friday. And both of them were sort of expressing this, like, they were interested in it, but it was the first World Cup they were interested in. It was like, it felt like this was, you know, it seems like even if it's been big in the U.S., this is like the first year where I'm sure that's not true. I mean, obviously Germany's won a couple of World Cups in the last, you know, Japan, a lot of places, but it feels like in a lot of parts of the world, this is like the first time people are really paying attention to the World Cup. So just speaking broadly, are there a couple of sort of key talking points going into the World Cup, a couple of things that, you know, everyone's sort of talking about in the lead up that you could get into a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big ones is the depth of the field. I think it was discussed a little bit coming into 2015, but certainly you look at, I think that second tier, for lack of a better term, with no disrespect to them, has kind of edged its way toward challenging and being able to run with and even defeat some of these sort of traditionally powerhouse programs. I mean, an example being a U.S., and you look at an Australia, who I think is a wild card of a team, but you know, you look at some of these results that those two teams in particular have had in friendlies over the past few years, and you know, that's not a team, Australia, that would have traditionally really been able to roll with the U.S. and certainly in a major tournament. And you've seen kind of a shift in that. So I think, you know, speaking to a more macro level of that, you have a bunch of, I think it's the most wide open World Cup we've seen yet. Now, look, I mean, we could get down to the final four and it's, you know, your usual suspects, but I think it's wide open. And I think where that'll come into play will be, you know, like in Russia last year, where we saw this ridiculously lopsided bracket after the knockout stage, you know, as the knockout stage filled out, should that happen in this Women's World Cup, where I think it's potentially even more possible with the third place teams advancing. You know, we could see kind of a surprise run to a semifinal or a final. And, you know, I think there's probably more than your usual kind of three, four teams that you'd kind of confidently say would be there. And equally, you know, to that point, I think the U.S. along with other teams is a team that could repeat. And I kind of feel like I said this in 2015 as well, but, you know, could be out in a very early stage. I mean, everybody's kind of looking at that quarterfinal potential game in Paris, USA, France. I think there's a lot that has to happen to get there, but everybody's kind of penciled in.
So I was looking at some website, an odds website, saying that France, probably just because they're the host nation, has equal odds as the United States to win this tournament. So France, just apart from being the host nation, their squad is up and coming, and it sounds like they have the players to compete.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, more than up and coming, this is kind of their moment, make or break moment, really. I mean, you look at this generation of players, a handful or more than a handful, but, you know, a part of this generation that really came through in that 2011 sort of surge where that started, and France made that run to the semifinals and nearly, you know, had the U.S. on the ropes for a bit in that semifinal. And it's really been disappointment since then. I think I've picked France in every major tournament since then and been disappointed. So my running theory is that I'm not going to pick them this time around, and I'm sure they'll win it. But
until you do, we're going to put your feet to the fire in a few minutes here. So can you, I'm sort of, maybe it's just because I saw this, the amazing new Nike commercial this afternoon. I don't know if that's, I assume that's an international commercial, but you know, it finishes with Sam Kerr. And so I'm really intrigued by her. I mean, I have to be honest, I you know, didn't know who she was going into this tournament. And, you know, I look now, I mean, you know, it looks like she has, you know, 77 caps for Australia. She's 25, she plays in Chicago. So I probably should have known who she was already. But what's the story with Sam Kerr?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously you can add an arguably to this, but best player in the world, you know, alongside a couple of others who can make that claim. A different player than you know, Nada Hegerberg, who, you know, has obviously won that award, the first Ballon d'Or. But I would say certainly two sort of FIFA votes ago, I think Sam Kerr was certainly got my vote for that, for best player in the world. And she's just, I think Americans can particularly appreciate that she's just kind of this pure goal scorer who has that sort of physical element, but is obviously also, you know, very technical. And she's got this sort of aura to her as well. It's kind of she's very grounded, but she's kind of, at this point, I would say, if she's not already a bona fide superstar, I think to the really wider public, that doesn't know her yet, she should be after this tournament. She's been doing what she's been doing for a couple of years now. So,
yeah. And is Australia good enough? I mean, could she, like, what's, is there like a, you know, could Australia make the elimination rounds? Could they make a semifinal? Like, what's, you know, yeah, like how quality is her team?
I mean, Australia is anywhere from a surprise champion to bombing out round of 16. And I don't mean to couch that. It's really Sam Kerr. I mean, they're a team that, I mean, maybe like the U.S., the way that recent results have gone, they're a team that, like, she can carry them on her back, and they need her to score, because defensively they're incredibly suspect. I think if they had a little bit of depth at center back, not even depth, I mean, honestly, they haven't found a solution in the center of the park starting wise for their center backs that has really worked. So I think if they had a better back line, I'd probably be picking them as kind of like a hipster pick to win the tournament. But whereas I was doing that to a degree in August, I've really soured on them over the past 6 months or so, just because of their back line. Sam Kerr could go score, you know, 6-7 goals in this tournament, but I
gotcha. Don't know. It's kind of like Liverpool before Van Dijk joined, right? So there's just something, yeah. Something. No, they weren't quite there yet. I like Australia as a dark horse, though. I'm going to
Socceroos. Let's go.
It's just the power of branding, perhaps.
It's a good gamble.
So one thing, I sort of mentioned this earlier, you know, talking to a couple people during the Champions League final on Saturday, but you know, it does seem like the growth of the FA Women's Super League in Great Britain has really, maybe it's just England. I think it's probably just England, not Great Britain as a whole. But has the growth of that? Do you feel like that's changing the game at all? Like, is that like, are you feeling that, like, that there's like more sort of energy or excitement, maybe just in England itself, for the, you know, for women's football?
Yeah, I would say England, and I would broaden it a bit to Europe, just based on some of the commercial deals that we've seen. And I don't mean to make it like a business thing, but I would say in terms of how I've been seeing it and feeling it from the US, I mean, there's a very clear movement over the past 6 to 8 months of significant investment in the women's game in Europe through deals like the Visa deal, and then, you know, Nike joined on that not far after, where they're packaging the entirety of the Euros, of the UEFA Champions League. There's been a lot of investment there at a time when the NWSL here domestically has really struggled on a business front. So I think that's been a pretty jarring dichotomy of what's going on in Europe from an investment standpoint, and what seems to be, even from the inside here, a lack of that on the NWSL front. So I think that's been felt. I mean, I know I've spoken with players who've seen that. You know, you look at one of the interviews that we had last year, just kind of always comes front of mind. Allie Riley talked to us and said, you know, she moved from the Damallsvenskan in Sweden, which, you know, in past years, maybe more so decades, but has traditionally been one of the best leagues, and just said, you know, I don't think it's there anymore. And I think England is where I need to be to pursue dreams of Champions League and everything else. And obviously Chelsea was pretty close this year. So I think the, you know, above all the investments there, and obviously that attracts players. And
well, didn't Alex Morgan go play for, was it Lyon, when they went on a tournament run a couple seasons ago?
She did, yeah. I mean, you know, Lyon is kind of its own class. I mean, it's you know, Harlem Globetrotters.
Ah, I see.
Thing. So, like the French league is Lyon and PSG, and even from an investment point, I mean.
So by just, Harlem Globetrotters, you mean Alex Morgan was just throwing confetti on people in the stands during lulls on the matches?
Yeah. I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches at Lyon. So you know, that's obviously, you know.
But surely all of the investment in Europe that you're that we're talking about, and especially in England, is what is adding to this depth of field that could make this one of the more intriguing World Cups.
Exactly.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, even down to, you know, if you're talking dark horses, I'm not going to say to win the tournament by any means, but a team that maybe makes a run that traditionally would be like, well, where'd that come from? Spain. Spain has invested in youth programming, and you've seen that at U17, U20 World Cups, where they've been, you know, among the best teams, and they won almost every trophy in a short 1 year span, essentially. And you know, you see that with Spain in the youth programming. You see that with some of the investment they've made through La Liga and you know, in the domestic league there. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's kind of the micro level of the investments within countries, and it's kind of now starting to trickle up to, or move its way up to, these senior teams. And you're seeing it now, too, you know, at a broad sort of continental level.
EA Sports is the ultimate bellwether, and that women have been integrated into the FIFA game since about 2 years ago, I think, speaks to what all these big business investors believe the potential of this market is, and the involvement of younger and younger women getting interested in the game. So yeah, it is fascinating. So if you were to play, I have a question for you, Jeff. If you were to play any female player in FIFA on the video game right now, who would it be?
Like I'm just her. Or I'm playing.
Well, all right. Yeah. Well, pick a team and then let's drill down to the player
here, Brandon.
I mean, I guess I'm sure, I haven't looked at the rankings, but I'm sure that the US is probably, you know, well received in the ranking department, and probably is sort of set up in that game to do very well. So Yeah, I mean, I think probably look, for depth, the U.S. is as good, if not better, than anybody else in the world. So, yeah,
I heard an interview with Megan Rapinoe, who was talking about the U.S. style of play when they won in 2015. She was feeling maybe this was sort of her playing the press junket ahead of 2019, but saying in 2015 they were playing more of a haphazard long ball or get it out to the wings and just cross it into Wambach. But she feels the style that the U.S. is now playing going into the 2019 tournament is more focused, more quote possession based, a little more positive. Do you see any truth to that assessment for Megan Rapinoe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, among everybody, I think she's traditionally a pretty straight shooter on kind of what's going on, and she'll tell you when it's bad. And she's done so even recently, honestly, because they've had a couple of different results that have been not as great this year. I mean, certainly 2015, look, they were poor up until that quarterfinal, and then, you know, insert the conspiracy theory that Jill Ellis got lucky because Lauren Holiday and Megan Rapinoe got suspended and she had to make changes. But, you know, once those changes were made, which she still had to make the right choices, obviously, they were a different team from that group stage and that round of 16. So, I thought beginning of 2015, you know, they got whooped in France in a friendly, really exposed. They really didn't look good that spring. They didn't look good in the opening of that tournament. And then they just kind of figured it out, which, to be fair, is you know, part of what a major tournament is. Sometimes it's just getting by. This time around, yeah, I mean, they've shifted. You know, they're not in that sort of strict 4-4-2 that they always played, certainly in the Pierson-Haga era as well. 4-3-3, it's a lot more dynamic. It leaves them a bit more exposed, for sure. But they've actually, you know, they've found some technical players to kind of buck the stereotype of just long ball. They're a much better possession team, a much more aesthetically pleasing team now, but we'll see if that, you know, at the same time that's been happening, the world has sort of, the teams around them have been developing this as well. So it's going to be interesting. Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the one thing that I was reading just in the lead up to this conversation was that the U.S. had the U.S. women's team, I think, is the oldest team by average age going into the 2019 World Cup, which on the one hand is kind of fun because I'm like, hey, I know all these players. But on the other hand, is that a little worrisome? I mean, are there, you know, who are the sort of, well, I mean, yeah, I'll just ask that. I mean, is the team a little old to you, and is that a concern?
Well, so they were actually the oldest team in 2015 as well. So I kind of chuckled when that stat came out last week, I think it was, that it was very predictable, because the thing with the U.S. as well is that a young player in the U.S. is not young by the world standards. I mean, you know, Tierna Davidson is the youngest off the top of my head, 22, I think. So, you know, even the quote-unquote young players of this team that haven't been to a major tournament are, you know, 23, 24, 25, they're not your, you know, European superstar 19-year-olds coming through the ranks type of thing. So I don't know that it worries me per se. I mean, there's other things that jump out that are more sort of front and center that would worry me, like the back line and the lack of chemistry there, and just they've been leaking goals in the spring. I don't think that has anything to do with age per se. I mean, you've got young enough players on the back line for the most part anyway.
Brandon, you're suddenly, I can feel your worry just like it's pulsating right now, Brandon, on the microphone.
Yeah, it's getting tense. though, I am getting super excited to watch Tobin Heath play. She's one of my favorite players on the U.S. team. I believe anything is possible when she's on the pitch.
That sounds like a t-shirt.
Exactly. That might have been that Nike ad I saw earlier.
We're in trouble of talking about the U.S. team too much. So the question that everyone wants to know with the tournament is, what's the group of death?
Oh man, no, I can't. The cliche group of death. But I will say those first 2 days, those two groups are extremely interesting, and I think particularly Group A, but certainly Group B, are much more wide open than we're probably in a sort of mainstream, you know, US-centric, Euro-centric view of things going to give credit to. Because I think, you know, you look at B, Germany, I think Germany is a very divisive team right now as public opinion goes. But obviously a traditional power will be expected to win that group, will be at least internally expected to win the tournament. But China is really a decent team. I think they showed that in 2015. They've showed it, excuse me, in friendly sense. Spain, like I mentioned before, is a much better team than I think most will give credit for. Honestly, the thing about this group, like, people are going to look at South Africa and just completely dismiss. It's going to be one of those things where if you're a German fan or a Spain fan, like, Spain is probably looking at this saying, all right, we can at least get second in this group. We're getting 3 points off South Africa. Like, South Africa has shown that they're a team that is extremely disciplined. They don't break down very often. They've gone to two straight Olympics where they've essentially played out, you know, played teams tough. They've earned some 0-0 draws. I mean, they're not an easy team to break down. So I think that's a group that's really quite open. I think Group A is probably a little bit more open than maybe meets the eye. I mean, Nigeria is a bit of a wild card. I think they've been on a bit of a downslope, you know, in recent cycles anyway. Norway, I know there's a lot of attention on for other reasons.
Sure.
Actually, yep. A very good team. And Korea Republic, I don't see a lot of, but I know it has. I know some of the individual players have certainly of quality and have done well in Asia. So those two groups, and I would quickly say Group E, I'm interested in because Canada is the seeded team. I'm never very high in Canada. I think they're just kind of traditionally like perennially like a quarterfinalist team. And you know, New Zealand, Netherlands, obviously, I think that could be another group that kind of gets a little wild.
Is Norway really hindered by the absence of Ada Hegerberg, the Ballon d'Or winner? She's today, we're actually going to talk about this in a little bit from one of our listener questions, but her being this talismanic player and the best female player in the world, according to FIFA, is her absence from Norway really going to damage their chances in the tournament?
Well, I mean, I think just by her pure quality of what she would bring from a traditional sort of skill set, you know, looking at it that way. Yeah, I mean, there's no way. I mean, if you're asking, is Norway better or worse without her? Would they be better with her?
Certainly. I'm here to ask the tough questions, Jeff.
Yeah, but you know, I think this is it's still a very good team. I think certainly much better than it was in 2015 coming into the tournament. So yeah, I think it's, you know, there's a lot at play there, obviously, but it's a team that, you know, she is. If not the best player, one of the best players in the world, depending on who you ask, kind of thing. And she would definitely make any team she's on better.
All right, I've got one final question then. We're going to do a quick lightning round of some listener questions. So there are six matches set this weekend. It's Germany, China, Spain, South Africa, Norway, Nigeria on Saturday. And then Sunday, we've got Australia, Italy, Brazil, Jamaica, England, Scotland. Of those six matches, let's say that you've never watched a single Women's World Cup match or a single, maybe just a single women's football match at all. If you were just going to dip your toe in of those six matches, is there one that stands out to you that should be really, you know, competitive or, you know, a great crowd or just something, you know, stands out to you?
Tough one. I mean, yeah, I think the easy answer would be England, Scotland, just because of, I think a lot of folks are kind of viewing that in a traditional kind of sense of if those men's team met, but I think Brazil, Jamaica would be a game. If I had to pick one of those that I would say has the potential to be really fun. Jamaica's playing in its first World Cup. This will be its first World Cup game ever. Brazil enters this tournament, not only on a ridiculous losing streak, but also with a lot of banged up players that just saw before we recorded that had to make a roster replacement. So, you know, Brazil, a team that people are going to look at and say, oh, Brazil, Marta, you know, that's a big team. Brazil has been on a downturn really for the last 8 years, really, certainly over the past four. And Jamaica is a team that, you know, they're not world beaters, but first World Cup game, they made some noise in the qualifying tournament. They have Bunny Shaw, Khadija Bunny Shaw. They have some players that can do some things. I mean, I think could be a cool atmosphere. Certainly if fans from both of those countries turn out, it's a, you know, Jamaica would be a team that I think a neutral in the stands could get behind. So I think it could have a fun atmosphere. It could have kind of a headliner shocking result potentially. And it could just be, I mean, especially with Brazil, I mean, who knows? It could be, you know, a 6-7 goal game too.
That is a total wild card answer. And I see now I'm excited for all of these games, Brandon.
I want to root for Jamaica. I want to root for Jamaica, as Jeff says, but I still can't get that Brad Guzan handball out of my mind. I don't know if you remember from the Gold Cup. Was that a couple years ago? But I don't know. It's a CONCACAF obstacle for me.
Being
a U.S. fan.
All right, let's, Brendan. Should we move on to the question section of this podcast?
Yeah, it wouldn't be an episode of Always Cheating without a traditional lightning round with some questions from our listeners. So the first one comes from our friend Eric Freeman. He wants to know, I would love to hear Jeff's thoughts on how much influence star athletes have over the future of the Women's World Cup, especially in cases like Ada Hegerberg's holdout from the Norway team for fair play and treatment. Can we expect change, or is the business of football bigger than these players? So Ada Hegerberg is sitting out this World Cup for Norway because of pay scale issues with Norway's national team. Is that a fight that she is expected to win? And does this, the U.S. women have been vying for similar fair pay treatment. I mean, considering the fact that the women in the U.S. actually win tournaments that the men can't even qualify for, it's crazy that they don't get paid as much as the men. But are these battles that we're thinking that women are looking to win, or where are we in the state of play?
Yeah, I mean, and Hegerberg's actually goes pretty deep into she hasn't really fully explained every little detail, and said that she won't, but she's kind of got a sort of longer list of things that the Norwegian FA and the country as a whole are not doing for, or that she sees is not doing for women. So, I mean, I think incremental change would be, something that you can expect to kind of see. And I think you have seen it when the starting point is a ridiculous sort of mistreatment, maybe incremental change is not the answer that people want to hear, and it shouldn't necessarily be the one that they expect. But I mean, even down to, like, if we rewind 4 years ago, and really more like 7 years ago, I guess 7-8 years ago, you know, FIFA pulled a bunch of crap, if we're being honest, of putting this 2015 tournament on turf, and, you know, pretty much figured they could get away with it. I know, depending on who's listening to this, it's not as big of a deal, but players weren't happy. That fight dragged on for 2 years or so. And what came of that? Well, you know, essentially it came down to a meeting, Abby Wambach, a couple other folks, representatives sitting with FIFA January of that year before the World Cup, and getting a verbal promise that it won't be on it won't be on artificial turf ever again. And you can actually see in the bidding for 2023, which is going on right now, that natural grass is specifically listed as a requirement for the bidding nation, which ridiculously, I guess, didn't actually exist in the past. So I think you see things like that. You see what the U.S. is doing off the field. Obviously, the big stuff suing the federation, but also kind of figuring out that they have value, that they have commercial value in what they're doing, that they should get paid. And if the federation isn't going to pay them, not only are they going to sue their employer, but also they're going to go find their worth essentially through sponsorships and endorsements, and they've signed a lot of these different deals. So I might be going long on lightning round here, just to say,
you wouldn't be the first, Jeff.
Yeah, I think you'll see change, but I mean, you know, as far as like, is the prize gap gonna close dramatically? You know, I think my end answer is usually it's FIFA. So,
right. Yep. Sure exactly. Enough. Yeah. It ends every argument, doesn't it? all right. Next question comes, and I think we've already discussed this next one a little bit, but Trevor Ingerson says, yeah, he'd love to know how the U.S. women's national team is viewed by Europe. I'll actually expand that to include the rest of the world. He says he feels like the gap is closed, but is that how other countries feel?
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as the view of the U.S., I think it's a mix of, you know, some of the smaller nations in these battles that we were talking to kind of view the U.S. as sort of the beacons and the change agents that are fighting for you know, change in the world and kind of following their lead. I think, you know, on the field, the U.S. is viewed as, you know, kind of an arch enemy by many, and maybe resented a bit for its winning ways and some of its perceived arrogance.
Canada feels that way for sure, right?
yeah. Canada is the chief rival, and it's obviously the most lopsided rivalry in like the history of sports for a legitimate rivalry. It's, you know, I think it's, they haven't beat the U.S. in, I don't have it in front of me, but like a decade. So, you know, it's been a while. So, I think gap closed a while ago is like, look at the youth tournaments and you can see how much, you know, that's what's coming through the pipeline. Obviously the U.S. is struggling mightily in youth tournaments and you have countries like Spain that are really dominating in those areas.
All right. Next question, Max Football. He asks, how much credit should England get for winning the She Believes Cup? And what precedent does this set for the Women's World Cup? So, She Believes Cup, that is this a tournament that happens every year?
Yeah, every late winter, early spring, February, March. I mean, you know, I would say independent of each other, England is one of the main contenders of this World Cup, and that I don't really rate She Believes Cup results all that high. I mean, certainly it was, you know, it was a notable tournament to win, but you know, in the end, it is a friendly tournament. I mean, Japan, for example, is just constantly experimenting and was still doing so there. You know, obviously, beating the U.S. is always kind of laying down a marker. So I would say She Believes it's a decent feather in the cap, I guess, but I don't rate it that much. But with that said, certainly England is a big contender for this World Cup.
All right. Next question comes from Tom Campbell. He says, do you envision there being a mixed gender game being played a la mixed doubles in professional tennis in the future?
No, I mean, it never really crossed my mind, to be honest.
nor mine. I'm sort of intrigued now that you raised it, but yeah. I never considered that either.
I think the only thing would be Olympics probably. And soccer is just so, it's just so low on the priority list. I mean, FIFA made it a U23 event for the men, and I just couldn't see it happening other than the Olympics. And that's a crowded space. I mean, the last I heard, they were thinking about not 3v3, like the 3v3 basketball. They were thinking about like small-sided soccer, right? But I never heard anything about a mixed.
Yeah, the only mixed gender game I'm familiar with is the six-a-side co-ed league that I play in, and all the men were just like disgusting lumps of flesh that we were stuck in the back playing defense. And the women are up front, physical, able to actually run, control the ball. So I can see this mixed gender game basically leaving men in the dust.
This is true. I met Brandon Jess from your six-a-side league a couple of days ago.
She's a tenacious player.
So much more fit than you and I. It's insane. All right. So final question. This is one that we actually talked about a little bit offline before the podcast started. But Tacoma Toffee asks how the U.S. and the European media differ in how they cover women's soccer or / football. I guess what I'm sort of curious about is, do you see there being a lot more coverage in Europe over the last few years? Is there a rise in European coverage of women's football?
Yeah, I think there's been a rise. I mean, I don't get to see as much of the kind of day-to-day there, but I do think from my sort of viewpoint of being in the day-to-day here in the U.S., I think that there's kind of there's always been a bit of a more appetite, at least digitally and maybe even on TV. You know, there's certain standards in the U.S. I mean, it's even so much as like you can watch an NWSL game from anywhere in the world. And it's just streamed over the website. And if I want to watch a FAWSL game, I mean, for the most part, can't unless I'm doing VPNs and everything else. So I think there's kind of more of that daily, I don't want to call it blog, but digital appetite here. But over there, I actually look and I'm like, you know, I see things where back to kind of the commitment, like there, I mean, even recently there are major media brands that have launched women's sports and soccer as kind of a leading example of it, of coverage of just for women's sports. And there are positions and people who are full-time committed to women's soccer over in Europe. And really doesn't exist. I'm here to tell you from someone who's been doing it for a while that those opportunities are few and far between and almost non-existent here in the U.S. So I'm not saying there's a lot of them in Europe, but it's an interesting sort of shift there as well on the media side.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how it changes too after after the World Cup this summer. All right, final question. I did warn you this was coming. The question is very simple. Who wins the 2019 Women's World Cup?
Well, I know what I said earlier, and I was sort of tongue-in-cheek, but in the spirit of 2011, 2012, 2015, and 2016, I think France is winning this.
Okay. All right. It's going to be a double, Brandon, of the Men's and Women's World Cup.
Who are you picking, Brandon? I have not heard your pick yet.
USA, baby. Listen, we're coming for you, France.
Well, I'm going to go Austria. I'm going to go with my dark horse candidate then. I'm all in on, I don't know why I'm so like intrigued by this Sam Kerr thing, but I really got sucked in reading about her. I'm just interested. I don't know. I mean, obviously I'll be rooting for the US women's team, but then maybe I'll be like, you know, betting on the,
yes. I was going to say, I haven't looked at those odds, but I think if you put money, Australia is probably one that could pay you a bit more because they're not.
It is, you know, true, not that, Josh. Yeah,
gambling's not illegal. Gambling, you know, if gambling were legal in the United States, of course, yes, they had the caveat.
If only there were a way. It's true, though, as you say, Josh, the Sam Kerr Nike ad commercial. Like, if this podcast hasn't gotten you psyched enough for the Women's World Cup, seek out the Nike World Cup commercial with Sam Kerr, and it'll leave you pretty breathless and wanting to watch these matches.
It was so nerdy. I have to admit, I actually did this though earlier tonight. I hadn't seen the commercial yet, and I had my wife, and I have a 2.5-year-old daughter, and my wife and daughter and I was like, all right, we all have to watch this together just to get us all excited for the World Cup. So everyone was very into it. My daughter even started kicking a soccer ball around afterwards. So awesome. So I'm definitely excited.
All right, Jeff. So the title of the book, again, is The Making of the Women's World Cup, Defining Stories from a Sport's Coming of Age. Your co-author is Kieran Thievam and Tatham. And you've got a forward here from legendary English goal scorer Kelly Smith. How did you land that one?
Yeah. You know, I guess we've kind of both, certainly Kieran even more so than myself. I've known Kelly through the years. She obviously played in the US as well. And she's in the media space now too. So, you know, thankfully, you know, she was kind enough to do that. And, you know, obviously we have a huge respect for her and you know, she respects kind of what we've been doing with trying to grow the game through, you know, grow the women's game through our media positions. And, so she did the foreword for us, talking a bit about just kind of the feeling of what a World Cup is, and, you know, what it feels like to be in one as a player. I think you can actually get the preview of that on like Kindle preview if you're looking on Amazon or something. But and then you actually have a full chapter more or less on her and kind of England in that 2007 tournament, her breakout, and then that famous photo of her kissing the boot after she scores. So
amazing. Yeah. Cool. The Making of the Women's World Cup. Check it out at a fine bookstore near you. And also you can find Jeff at equalizersoccer.com or give him a follow on Twitter at Jeff Kassouf, JeffKassouf. Jeff, thanks a million for being on the OFG podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, much appreciated, Jeff. And I'll be following the coverage for sure. And I just went on a full-on follow spree over the last week or so, just picking up every good a lot of blogs and websites I should have been following already probably. But I feel like Twitter is always the place to go, but it sounds like Equalizer Soccer too is going to be a great place to get my fix over the next month or so. So and from then on, of course, too. Yeah. So thanks again, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for listening to the podcast. Obviously, we are we're still at least a month away from the site relaunching. I'd say about a month, right? Maybe the end of June. I expect early July is when we'll see the new site comments. Right around 4th of July, usually, right?
Yeah, and then the Premier League fixtures are being announced in like 2 weeks.
Yeah,
fairly soon.
Yeah. Coming soon. I still don't completely miss the fantasy game. I miss regular Premier League matches. The break from fantasy has been good for me, I think. You know, I like a couple more weeks away, it will serve me good. I feel like the Women's World Cup, I mean, I'm excited about it just to watch it, but I also feel like it'll cleanse my palate from like this sort of long, you know, 9 months of endless football that we've just watched.
I do think if you were starting to feel like you missed the Premier League, that the Champions League final was a good antidote to that. It was like, seriously, hey, here's what's basically a Premier League match, and it's kind of terrible.
Yeah, it was so bad. I don't know if it was. Yeah, I was listening to some podcast, and then they're like, was it the weather? Was it the early goal? Was it the layoff? And it was like, take your pick. You know, it was like everything was bad.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so I guess back into our hibernation, but if mm-hmm. you need us, you know where to find us. You can still subscribe and follow us on social. We're available wherever fine podcasts are found.
Yeah, and we actually we are doing a Patreon exclusive podcast next Monday. We'll be recording that. And we'll be doing some regular podcasts like this too. I like this sort of dive bomber approach that we're doing right now. You don't know when a podcast is going to come until we just drop it. It's like a low pressure way for us to record some podcasts. It's sort of fun. We'll pop it. Maybe we'll even do another Women's World Cup, so we see where we are in a week or two here. Definitely, probably not when the fixtures launch.
That keep might be your eyes solo, in the Brandon. Sky yep, for yep. the always cheating drone that's just going to exactly. Drop one on you.
But we might, I don't think when the fixtures are announced, we'll do a podcast. But, you know, certainly, before, you know, right around the time the game launches, you'll see regular podcasts from us. But until then, it might just be sort of these little one-off podcasts and interviews.
Cool. Well, a quick thank you to our producers, as usual, Mike DiPietro, Stephen Toomey, Sam Street, Carl Rasmussen, Leni Granley, Chris Howell, Rafikon, Martin Savage, Rick Brailsford, Jim Payne, Adam Benjamin, Max Chamberlain, Brian T., Trevor Ingerson, Chris Carter, the Big Gaffer, Bob Ascoon, Jeff Hustle and Flo, Ben Grant, James Holland, Matt Ritter, Kajitan, and Jazz Binning. And you know where to find us online, or just go to oascheating.com.
That's right. And once again, to become a Patreon supporter, go to patreon.com/alwayscheating. If you want to reach out to us, send us an email, hailcheaters@gmail.com, or you can just DM us on Twitter, or you can actually message us right through our website.
Fantastic. Josh, so 3 p.m. in the States, that's the kickoff for France, South Korea, the first match of the Women's World Cup. Looking forward to it.
Yep, I'm too. I'm actually looking forward to these matches. Now I'm kind of excited about this this Brazil. I thought that might be a skipper, but now I'm like, that's the match to watch this weekend. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, it's a Hail Tobin from me. Who's going to be your talisman this World Cup? Is it Kerr forever?
It's Kerr forever. Both Steve Kerr and Australia's Kerr. Both Kerrs.
So many great Kerrs out there in the mix. All right, everyone. Bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/BlueWire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.